You're listening to the Limitless, the podcast between. This is the third part of my exploration of Maurice Berman's Wandering God with Tim Kay. So, as a preamble, I edited our last talk. It's going to be up tomorrow. As I said, it took about an hour out, and I was fine with the result. But that hour that I took out, boy, am I glad no one heard that but us. And that's not often that, you know, I don't usually edit conversations. So, of course, I was curious, you know, what was going on there. And the simple, short answer is I was just trying too hard. And you should never try. And generally speaking, I don't ever try with these podcasts. So, and today I'm didn't sleep very well, so I'm pretty spaced out. So I'm thinking we'll balance it out with, I'll be particularly effortful today. You're gonna have to tease me out, otherwise I might just sit here and gaze.
Well, the rational mind is suppressed.
I'm hoping, yeah. Because I think you call upon me for my intuitive faculties more than, or as much as my analytical ones. Would you agree with that?
I would agree, yeah.
Okay. So with that disclaimer, let us re-embark on yes. Project Berman.
Okay. So here we are again, continuing with A Wandering God by Maurice Berman, and we're looking at chapter 3 today, a lot in there. And
As the Soul is Bent.
Yes.
Good title.
The title is The Soul is Bent, the Psycho-Religious Roots of Social Inequality.
Got quite a squeaky chair there. Even
yeah,
unfortunately. Squeakier than mine.
I try to remain still. Okay.
Well, it looks like I have very few annotations. This so it's going to make it easier for me to be quiet or whatever, passive. My first is on 111.
Okay. I'm starting from the very beginning. So let me go ahead and dive right in. Okay, starting on page 85. I go to the second paragraph. Okay, so Berman says, all human organisms go through two early processes or events that rupture the primordial experience of unity with the mother and with the world. The first is physical birth. The second, which is much more tenuous and prolonged, is psychological birth. The second rupture is what concerns us here, for it marks the beginning of the journey towards individual identity, self-conscious awareness, in the experience of fear and alienation. This begins the dialectic of self and other, and even under the most benevolent child-rearing conditions, fear and alienation are going to be present. It is this primary rupture to which Eugene O'Neill and the Mazatec shaman referring to the conclusion of the previous chapter.
Why Eugene O'Neill, by the way? Isn't he the playwright?
Yeah, I don't know which play he's referring to there.
The Iceman Cometh, is that, that's the...
Probably.
That's,
I don't know what
his most famous, isn't it?
I think so. Yeah. Have you read the play?
No, but I've seen the screen version with Lee Marvin.
Can you go through the story? I don't know that well.
No, let's not. Let's just leave that a mystery.
Okay. All right. So there are conditions of birthing and of early child rearing that are much less traumatic than those of the Western industrial nations. But the nugget of uncanniness that the German philosopher Otto Bollnow refers to, Karen Horney's creature anxiety, which is the strangest of being alive at all, lies at the core of the human condition. Albert Camus' Stranger and Jean-Paul Sartre's Nausea are perhaps the most extreme portrayals we have of this. But the sociobiological evidence takes some kernel of it back to the Middle Paleolithic. So I have read Camus. Sartre.
Say it again.
I have read Camus and I have read Sartre.
Oh yeah, so have I. In my late teens or early 20s, that was the the foundation of my quest for knowledge in some way. I would say a very shaky foundation, but anyway, that was how it began. Kafka, soon after that. Dostoevsky was the turning point. At the age of 20, right when I turned 20, I began to read Crime and Punishment, which I assume was going to be quite a chore. Little did I realize that it would become the most engrossing book I ever read, and I've read it many times since then. So I see Dostoevsky is really very formative in my perspective, whereas the others not so much.
Yeah, for me it was Camus, which curiously enough, I read both Camus and Dostoevsky when I was a senior in high school. It was part of the World Literature Survey of senior age, you know, so I would have been about 16 or 17, and Crime and Punishment was pretty deep for a 16-year-old.
Yeah.
The Stranger, not so much, even though, you know, trying to understand what existentialism is, even though you have a little bit of a description there, it didn't click for me until later on after I started getting more into Sartre, and Heidegger, and Kierkegaard and all that, just more formal existentialism. Oh, that's what we're talking about here.
Mm. So for me, Sartre he did have an impact for me, although it wasn't really lasting. But when I read Nausea, I experienced quite powerful relief because I felt that finally I'd found somebody who was describing my experience.
The uncanniness.
I don't know if it overlaps with the uncanniness, but there was a phrase that I believe was mine, but it might have been Sartre, but certainly he seemed to describe it in his own terms, which is the meaningless pressure of objects. I'm pretty sure I came up with that. That thing came to mind when I was in my late teens, after many years of feeling this existential alienation and the sense of unreality. I hit upon that descriptor, not to say it was the best or anything, but that was how I was trying to make sense of it. And it was around that time I read Sartre, and he described something similar in terms of this kind of, well, what would you say the nausea is of the title of that book? Would you be able to sum it up?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember here. So the central figure is Roktan, I think that's what his name is. And so the nausea that Sartre refers to is the nausea or the uncanniness, the ill feeling that one feels towards existence.
Right.
And, you know, going back a few sentences, I think a better way to describe it is Karen Horney's, the creature anxiety. Now, as a self-aware creature, you know that the fact that I exist is itself strange. Why am I here? Mm-hmm. It's not the large question of why am I here, but why am I here at all? Maybe.
Oh, how am I here? How am I existing now? How is that even possible?
Right. Right. Yeah. The chance involved of, you know, I could have very well not been here.
Yeah. Well, there's infinitely more possibility that we wouldn't be here than that we would be here.
Right. Or that it would be somebody different than what I am.
Yeah. Yeah, although that's an intellectual flattening out of something that for me at least, and I think for Sartre, was visceral. There was a visceral sense of repulsion
right.
in the face of existence. And for me that sort of translated, I think, in a certain way, as I became an adult, into a kind of rage against objects, because I had many experiences, as I'm sure many people do, of coming up against the objective nature of reality. House renovating was brilliant for this, of course, and there's no budge, and just not being able to feel the powerlessness in the face of physical reality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. It's the visceral experience. That's really where the nausea comes from.
Yeah.
Okay, so going to the next paragraph. Berman continues, he says, as the infant grows and comes into self-conscious awareness, it has people and things in its environment that mitigate this uncanniness, act as a memory of that primordial unity in some way. Foremost among these is the mother's breast, and to be sure, the mother herself. In a hunter-gatherer situation, there are also forests, rivers, trees, and animals, and from the late Paleolithic, domesticated animals. There are also, of course, members of the family. Such cultures may not create dependency on transitional objects. And even infants in their own culture who are breastfed on demand and weaned late by our standards, apparently do not need these. Thus, the degree of separation in cathexis spans a broad spectrum of intensity from culture to culture.
In cathexis, what was that word? Cathexis?
Cathexis.
What's that word?
I believe it's projection. It's a psychoanalytical term. Separation in cathexis spans a broad spectrum of intensity from culture to culture and even within the same culture. But the constellation of alienation and attachment itself as a raw fact of life, as a constant for human life going back a very long time.
So detachment, clearly, in the sense of being just as birth causes separation physical, and then if we are breastfed, and I wasn't, then there's a period of gradual separation from the actual experience of breastfeeding and so on. So certainly separation in that sense is inseparable from autonomy, but alienation is that also? I mean, what's the basis, do you think, for saying that it's a, is he just saying that it's always been part of our existence, or that it's an inevitable part of it?
I think it's always been a part of our existence, because, you know, the main faces that he's getting towards is vertical versus horizontal. So hunter-gatherers were more horizontal, seeking outward from what was around them in their immediate space instead of projecting upward. The projecting upward, the sacred authority complex, as he describes it, is a direct result of this sense of detachment or alienation from, you know, we have this sense of being part of the world, but also not part of the world. And this is where the paradox comes in.
So as we feel disconnected horizontally, which is to say from our peers, or to begin with our parents, but our experience of being embedded in a collective body, we start to project upward. We start to compensate with a vertical perspective,
right,
more or less now. And this seems to be related to the loss of the mother's body, the creation of a transitional object, correct me where I go wrong, and thereby the generation of internal images.
Right. So I had a question about being breastfed. I know that I wasn't breastfed. It wasn't a thing back. You know, we're close to the same age, so I think for a time it was just considered
unhealthy, yeah.
Unhealthy or gauche for the mother to breastfeed. Now, you were not breastfed and I was not breastfed, but do you know people who were breastfed?
Certainly I do. I mean, I don't go around asking them, but it's come up, and I would say that I meet more people who are breastfed as a guest. I don't often hear people say, oh, me neither, when I give my lament, my eternal lament.
Do you detect that these people are different from, because they were breastfed, and this is also not taking into account any other kinds of trauma that they suffered in their lives?
It's impossible, isn't it? Because there's no control, and it's too, so of course I've wondered that. But yeah, that's too broad a question. I'm still trying to discover the ways, or uncover the ways in which it has impacted me. Because it's not as though breastfeeding, being breastfed, guarantees a healthy maternal attachment. Far from it.
Right.
Not being breastfed would seem to guarantee an unhealthy maternal attachment, however.
Mm-hmm.
So then that follows that my unhealthy maternal attachment is particular to me, would have qualities to it that are specific to that, that I never even got to experience the breast. Now, what they are, this is just a guess, and it's throughout my writing recently, an unusual degree of rage and hostility towards my mother that extends into women and then extends into the world of physical objects, even wholly. You know, that's just a guess. I mean, we've got somebody like Ed Gein who I ended up writing about in 60 Maps Hell, who and then Psycho and Norman Bates, which is, you know, magnifies that complex. We don't know if they were breastfed or not. Maybe we could find out with Ed Gein. But anyway, the complex that I have is one that, generally speaking, remains hidden. So I can't be sure that it's more severe in me than in other men. It may just be that I'm more conscious of it or more honest about it. But I can deduce some sort of correlation there, that I was denied the natural transitional object, really, if you like. I mean, is the breast, it's not really even transitional, but let's say it's transitional between the womb and total separation. So in that sense, it is a transitional object. That would be the natural transitional object, wouldn't it? The breast.
Seems to be, yeah.
And so I was denied that. And, well, I mean, it's easy to see how that would have a major impact, and but it's weirdly combined with the fact that it's something I didn't even think about for the first 40 years of my life. I never had this thing. I was never breastfed. It just was just one of the facts of my life, just as my mother being an alcoholic. I mean, maybe it was better I wasn't breastfed because there was less alcohol in the manufactured milk. I don't know, but there was certainly alcohol in the womb when I was gestating.
Yeah.
So that was also a very profoundly impactful fact of life that I just took for granted until I started to really self-examine.
Right, apart from not being breastfed, I think particularly for men, another trauma that is, I think, recently now been acknowledged, although in the past, when you and I were growing up, nobody ever questioned it, was circumcision. So I was circumcised since living in the States. I'm not sure at the time, were the British still circumcising boys?
No, definitely not. I didn't even know that they ever were. I thought it was just a Kellogg's conspiracy.
No, it was just a matter of course. Now, I don't want to get into the nitty-gritty of things, but I was circumcised in a certain way where some not the foreskin, but the attachment, there's a lump of skin that's around there. Whereas other men, it was completely removed. So I'm not quite sure why that is, but there's also a fusion between the glands and the rest of the shaft, which a urologist had pointed that out to me when I went for a checkup about 10 years ago. And it was an older urologist, and he says, yeah, that he's seen that kind of thing before, where it's not common, but he has seen cases like that before. But the point of bringing it up is that, I was not breastfed and then I was circumcised. So already there, I have a separation trauma that stretches way back, and then another invasive trauma that also stretches the way back. But I think also in reading some of this, where, Berman is talking about, although there's the separation, the fact that there's a healthy family, we'll say, an extended family, might mitigate some of that separation anxiety. And I know that certainly was in the case with me because when I was growing up, I went to a private school where my mother was the secretary. It was from first grade to eighth grade. So going to school was just going with my mother to work because she worked there. It wasn't that I got on the bus and I went across town to another school, and I did that for the better part of 8 years and then repeated again in high school. And I had a close-knit family. My parents never divorced. There wasn't any kind of abuse that I knew of that was going on between myself and my sister. So it was a very warm, loving, stable childhood. And I think had things been different, if I had alcoholic parents or divorced parents or suffered some kind of sexual trauma, then that would have compounded what it is I already experienced as an infant.
Yeah, of course that makes perfect sense. It's like a wound that isn't dressed and properly intended won't heal. You froze up for a
Yeah.
second there.
So did you. So, I mean, in the case of your mother, because she was an alcoholic, so obviously she was drinking when you were in the womb.
Yeah, even in the hospital during the delivery period, she snuck brandy in. And these were the stories I grew up with, those funny stories. And it was, and as I say, they get normalized. It's part of my eccentric background, and it's consistent with the myth of the tortured artist, saying that that's the fertile ground for creative genius to flower in, and so on. That was part of the context, I think. Certainly my father and my mother romanticized alcoholic writers. So that's a big part of it, isn't it? The consciousness and the value set that we internalize prevents us from seeing the nature of our trauma.
Now, when did you really start to question it?
In my 40s, I would say. I mean, it's hard to say because I was always questioning everything. So I probably did talk about not being breastfed in my 20s. I could check with my sister. So at an intellectual level, I may have been questioning all of that, and certainly the alcoholism. I mean, there was no way to not be aware that that had a horrible effect, because I was seeing it throughout into my adulthood with my mother anyway, and my father. So, but there's a difference between an intellectual conceptual sense and really an aha moment, or a series of aha moments. And I'd say that the aha moments where I started viscerally experiencing how cut off I was from my life force and my energy and my soul and my love of life, that sense didn't begin until in my early 40s when I met Dave Ashana and my wife. And I guess, I mean, it was traditionally, it's the time, right? It is the turning point. One life ends and another begins, and what begins is that looking inward.
Yeah. Okay, well, before I continue to the next paragraph, let me go ahead and define what a transitional object is, because I think this is the first appearance. So this is a term that comes from D.W. Winnicott, the psychoanalyst. And basically what a transitional object is something that bridges the gap. So in the case of children, they have stuffed animals or a blanket. You know, I had stuffed animals and I had a blanket. You probably had the same.
Both, absolutely. Very important blanket I had. It was called my smelly, because I wouldn't let anyone wash it. And it, to everyone else, it smelled really bad. To me, it was a wonderful heavenly smell, and I would hold it to my nose, well, the blanket, until the point that just the part I held to my nose broke away from the rest of the blanket, and so that piece became my smelly. So it was known, and yes, I carried it everywhere with me.
It's your security blanket, much like Linus in the Peanuts cartoon has a security blanket.
Much like what?
Linus in the Peanuts cartoon has a security blanket.
Oh, right. Okay.
Some listeners would know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
So at what age did you ditch your smelly? You felt you didn't need it anymore.
Quite late. I believe I lost it. So it would have been around 7 or 8. I remember I almost said my wife there, my God, calling Dr. Freud. My mother washed it from time to time, and she would have to sneak in and get it when I wasn't there and wash it, because I would never let her wash it otherwise. And that was a terrible time, because it took days before the smell came back. It was quite late. It was quite late that I think I actually lost it, but I may be wrong. And if I lost it, no doubt now I can deduce that some family member took it away while I wasn't looking.
Yeah. So again, the purpose of a transitional object is because there's this core separation that happens with the infant and the child. This object, be it a blanket or a stuffed animal or some kind of a toy, stands in as a bridge between the child and reality until they reach such an age where they feel a little bit more not entirely in touch with reality, because there's still that separation, but they feel more comfortable in making their way in the world without relying on a crutch.
Yeah, you said between the infant and the child, by the way.
Oh.
So, but you meant the child and the mother, no?
Child and the world.
Oh, the world. Yeah, but it's the mother initially, isn't it? Or at least the caregivers.
Caregivers. Well, the mother is the child's world in the beginning. Yeah. Until it reaches an age where it has this, I am separate from my mother and I am separate from these other caretakers in the world, and then eventually they start becoming their own person. Oh yes, I am who I am. You know, the age that Berman passes out is 3, when you start the first sense of a self and other. And then maybe around, I don't know, 7 or 8 is when you start to come in one's own. so to speak.
Are you familiar with the book that he cites in here? I think it's The Mermaid and the Minotaur.
No.
Yes, well, we happen to have it on our shelf, so I picked it up after reading this, although I haven't continued with it yet. It's a very compelling and quite radical thesis that she, I think her name was Dinnerstein. That
Simone
she.
Din- yeah, Dinnerstein. I remember the name, but I haven't read the book.
Right. Yes, and it's essentially that because of the centrality of the mother in our child rearing practices for hundreds or if not thousands of years, which she's arguing isn't a natural primacy, all of our values or even our very identity is shaped by the mother's presence, and that really impacts and distorts our relationship to women, number one, and then to men, number two, to our own bodies, and so on. Like it's, anyway, I could go into more, but I don't want to balderize it. But one of the things that's so radical about it is she's stating something that I've intuitively known my whole life, I suppose, but which is that the hand that rocks the cradle rules the world. You know, we have the cliche, but the women define our social reality because they define our identities and our value systems and the way that we perceive the world.
Right. We could go on a whole other discourse about how men have become more feminized in recent decades, but that's a separate topic.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's go to the next paragraph again on page 86. Berman continues. He says, the mother-infant dyad also shows up as a constant as well, even among non-human animals. This is directly related to feeding and survival, of course, but warmth and holding are just as important. Given the human phenomenon of prolonged dependence, the infant deprived of these will die. This is John Bowlby. This is John Bowlby's monotropy, attachment to a specific caregiver in a one-to-one dyadic relationship that provides the organism with reassurance, basic trust in the world. Thus, while multiple caregiving, a larger than dyadic context, is quite common throughout the world and very likely to have been the historical norm as regards child rearing practices, all kinds of comparative studies come back to the truism that there ain't no one like mom. While we cannot know anything definite about patterns of Paleolithic child rearing, these studies do provide us with a strong sociological clues. Thus, in one study that Herbert Berry and Leonora Paxson did of child rearing patterns in 201 societies from around the world, which included hunter-gatherers, it turned out that almost all of them ranked the mother as being of great importance, regardless of how multiple the caregiving pattern actually was. Research with non-human primates also indicates that separation is much more traumatic for pure-raised individuals than for mother-raised ones. As Mary Ainsworth puts it, attachment behavior and maternal reciprocity may be labile, but they remain indistinctive nonetheless.
What was that last sentence? I mean, what does it mean? How do you understand it?
As Mary Ainsworth puts it, attachment behavior and maternal reciprocity may be labile, meaning it changes, but they remain instinctive nonetheless. So what I gather for this is that maybe there's a paradox involved. So, you know, the key term in the paragraph is dyadic, a one-to-one relationship between two individuals, in this case, the mother and the child. Mm-hmm. So that has been the norm in Western European societies, other societies too, for a long time. But in the distant past, this probably was not the case. It was more multiple caregivers, because right. If you were a child born to a tribe, you had a mother and father, but you had your extended family living in the same area. And then you had the rest of the tribe that you were passed along to. So you had a much more diffused sense of attachment instead of everything as the mother and then the father.
Yeah.
But Mary Ainsworth, who me quotes here, says that the detachment from that is probably more traumatic than it is just being separated from the mother. I'm not quite sure why that is. That's the way I read the sentence.
Yes, I was wondering why that is and what he's presenting that, how that's central to his thesis exactly.
Yeah.
But I guess we'll find that out, or maybe we won't.
Well, but one thing I wanted to say about this is I've heard others make make the point, and that's a very good one, is that extended family is much more important than nuclear family is. So, I mean, it stands to reason. In more traditional cultures, you do have an extended family, grandparents, aunts and uncles. And in my case, for my family, although I spent a lot of time with my mom and dad, my extended family was nearby. It's not like they were in another state across the country or somewhere else in the world. For example, a friend of ours, she is Australian, so a lot of her extended family is back in Australia. But she's a mature adult. It's not like she's a child that's just been separated from them. And I think that made a big difference. But people take it as a given that the nuclear family isn't the standard. But now, going back to what I touched on before, is that with the way boys are acting now, because the fathers are not in the home, everything is just stuck to the mother, whatever the mother is. And then the mother is stuck to the male child as a surrogate for the husband, type of dynamic that goes quite unhealthy.
And this is an unanswered question, or even unasked at this point between us. I mean that it's not just a question of is it the child and the mother, or the child and the extended family, but what about the child and the father? Because if the father was as central in raising the child or caring for the child, perhaps a better term, from day one, even though he doesn't have a breast, that would still be quite radically different from how it's been traditionally and
Right.
historically, you know? So I don't know if that's if he's raising that or not.
Yeah, I mean, again, in all the reading that I've done, the one thesis that emerges is that the father provides a sort of bridge between the outside world, where the child is a great child from infant until about 6 years old, is closely identified with the mother, and the mother is the primary caregiver. Father's just kind of around. He engages with the child if he is engaged in the family and he's not kicked out or has some other dysfunctions, like he's absent or domineering or an alcoholic, like in the case of your father, that it provides more of this structure. And as the, particularly for the male child, growing more into getting towards puberty, the father takes on a more central role, because a man teaches the boy how to become a man, the mother doesn't.
Talking about specifically about boys, yeah, certainly. I think it's Winnicott again, who I haven't read, it's all secondhand, my Winnicott, but I think it was Winnicott who described the correct dynamic as the child, the mother holding the child, and the father holding the mother. It's like Russian dolls, and similar to what you're saying, or included in it maybe, is that yeah, the mother's keeping the child safe, but the father's keeping the mother and the child safe. The buffer between the world and that little, second womb, and that seems reasonable to me. And certainly, the more comfortable, safe, at peace, trusting the mother feels, the more she's going to be able to nurture the child. All that seems common sense to me. But I still wonder. I mean, based on the Dinnerstein book, the fact that as children we're the most formative years, those really key years of the first 3 years, if we're mostly immersed in the mother's world, and our reference point is mostly the mother, is there some detrimental effect to that? Is that somehow out of balance, as it would seem to be, just in terms of yin and yang? Number two, and number one, and number two, is it necessary? Like, why couldn't the father do many of the things that the mother does? Holding it, changing the nappies in the modern age, and so on. Right? Why isn't the mother and the father? And presumably, part of the answer is that the mother and the infant have a particular psychic bond, because the infant grew inside the mother's body. So then the question is, what's the healthiest way to dissolve that psychic bond? And that's the question. Obviously, I don't have the answer to it.
I went down to the railroad, and I saw your train. I went down to the railroad. I knew you weren't coming back.
the case of your father, because you've talked about it before, if your father had been different from what he was, would that have counterbalanced what had been going on with your mother? I mean, of course, there wasn't a whole lot that you could have done about the dysfunctions of your mother, because she was an alcoholic. And she partnered with also another alcoholic, and, you know, yeah. It's a double whammy right there. But if your father had been healthier, or, you know, this is all speculation, if your father had been healthier to try to counterbalance that somewhat and put his foot down more often, that definitely would have changed things. But it didn't work out that way, of course.
No, he couldn't contain my mother, and never mind control her, because control isn't a good thing anyway, generally speaking, but he couldn't handle her. So yeah, he wasn't there to protect her from herself, you could say, and therefore certainly not there to protect us from him, from her. But this, I mean, it's very difficult to speculate, because we're talking about a period that we don't remember. Not only that, we don't remember, most of us, the nature of it, as in what is it like to be an infant interfacing with the mother or the father or the will. We actually don't really have a memory of that, or I don't anyway. Maybe you do.
No, I don't. Sometimes I've tried to reach back. My earliest memory is being in the crib. Was I a baby at the time? 1 year old? I can't really say. And the memory I have is very faint, diffuse. It's at night. So it might not even be an actual memory. Maybe it's a concocted memory. I can't say. Really, I would say, because I was thinking about this the other day, is that probably around the 6 or 7 is when I started to really, that's probably as far back as I can go with solid memories that I'd say, yes, I did experience that. Anything before 6 years old is, this is out of reach.
So that's how it is for me, but that's fairly unusual in my experience. Most people I've met can remember further back. So that would seem to be at odds with your very peaceful, wholesome childhood.
I am who I am. I mean, that's part of the problem.
But you also are who you once were.
Yes. Yes.
The buried portion of Tim.
Yeah. I haven't gone through an exorcism, something equivalent to that, to try to find the buried parts. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's best just to keep sleeping dogs alive.
I think with an exorcism, yeah, that's disinterring the nastiest parts, isn't it? But necessarily to get them out. But I was thinking more of the buried treasure.
Yeah. Okay. Well, going to the next page, page 87, the section child rearing in Western versus non-Western cultures. So he starts off in the first paragraph. The greatest difference between first and third world patterns of mother-infant interaction lies in the emphasis on somatic attention, in the latter case as opposed to visual and vocal attention in the former. That is to say, both Western and non-Western societies provide their infants with what Donald Winnicott calls a holding environment. But in one case, the holding is largely tactile, while on the other, it is primarily emotive, interactive, verbal and visual. This pattern has been confirmed by numerous studies, including ones that have used video equipment to document the details of mother-infant interaction. It can be seen in hunter-gatherer societies, and in agricultural societies such as those of rural India, or in an industrial society such as Japan. We have to wonder what difference this shift in emphasis makes. So the point is, in the first world countries, it's visual, whereas in the third world countries, it's tactile.
I was just having a conversation about this, the difference between experiencing the world in a tactile way as compared to a visual, and how they also seem to correspond with vertical and horizontal in certain ways, and I hadn't really had this thought until yesterday, but anything visual by definition is separate from us. Like, we cannot see something that's touching us, because if we touch our eyes, we can't see that. So anything we can see with our eyes is separate from us. So there's something about vision, and of course that corresponds with vision reinforcing the idea of being in a world of objects as compared to something else, let's say, whatever that might be. And the tactile, we could of course, one is touching objects, so in a certain sense, tactile. But anyway, I don't want to get too distracted by all the different nuance of it, but certainly any tactile experience of the world is, by definition, in contact with it, whether or not we're feeling the separation or not, there might be emerging or there might not be. The initial experience in the womb, of course, is it's tactile without any sense of separation.
Right. Here's an interesting tidbit. Have you ever seen homunculus in cognitive science? Do you know what that is?
No.
So philosophically, there's the concept of the homunculus, the little man that's inside the head. Yeah. But in another sense, and you can see this on the net, you type in homunculus cognitive science, I think it is, and it shows this clay figure of a man. And each of the body parts is proportional to how connected to the brain it is. So like, for example, the eyes are small, but the hands are enormous.
Oh yeah, I have seen that guy.
And the feet are enormous.
Yeah.
So what that doing is that it's exaggerating in a certain sense what the brain takes in for sensation. So right. The hands are very important. The feet are very important.
Right.
What's less important? Genitals, ears. Well, I think the ears are somewhat large, but not as large as the hands. But what you think might be important, like the lips, well, the lips are important too. Teeth, well, teeth are, not, they don't have that many nerves in there. But it's interesting to look at that figure to see just where the concentration of the sensation is, how important it is.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, and that's probably interrelating with what Dave Oshana has been talking about in terms of our attention / awareness being confined to spaces where it's not really that useful as compared to the feet, for example. Right? Most of the day our awareness isn't in our feet, you could say. It's kind of here. What am I seeing? What am I hearing? What am I saying? This area where we identify with the self. For no good reason, really, and actually a bad reason if we start remembering the importance of tactile or sensation experience. But I'm curious to stay on that paragraph for a second. What's the correlation between a more visual-oriented caregiving and a more emotional verbal one? Because that seems very much, it was how I grew up. There wasn't much physical touch. But also the Western kind of view is that how do we love someone? We tell them we love them, right? It's all kind of, and it's all, it's words and it's feelings and it's showing and telling even, and maybe not even showing, but telling. And strong emotions are supposed to be the determinant of strong feelings. That's a bit tautological, isn't it? But maybe you're getting what I'm trying to say, that we have a particular way of expressing love and care that isn't actually necessarily that loving and caring.
No. Some would even say action is a form of love. If I do things for you, or if I'm present. I mean, I would probably argue is that doing things is less important than being there.
Yeah.
Number one.
Yeah.
Hugging someone or being tactile in that sense is carries a lot more weight with it than just being there. You mentioned that you didn't grow up in a touchy-feely family. I didn't either. I didn't even see my parents hug that much or kiss that much. And that was for a long, long time where I didn't see that.
Well, that's interesting because you referred to it as a very warm family environment.
Mm-hmm. Warm in the sense of, they were there, they were present, they were active with us, they provided for us, kind of indulged us, you could even say. But, I go back to what I was saying before about when it was time for me to go to school, I went with my mother there. She didn't ship me off, and there wasn't any daycare at the time, not like there is now. And so it worked out better is that wherever my mom went, I went with her. Went to school, went shopping. Sometimes my dad came with us if he was home and he wasn't working. So there definitely was a sense of presence there, just not so much in the terms of kissing, that kind of thing.
Did you like being around your mother a lot?
Yeah, I did. My dad too. I never had a I never had a problem with my dad. And it's a shame that there are a lot of kids that they don't have the same experience.
Well, I never hugged my dad. I mean, part of it was in later life he was in a wheelchair, so we were never standing up together. But I don't think I'd have got a hug even then. I mean, I would have been too awkward to ask. He would have been too awkward to give one. So as far as I know, I never got a hug from my dad. And even my mother wasn't that, you know, there were hugs for goodbyes and things. But I mean, to this day, I have a difficulty with physical touch. And I mean, a lot of the time, I don't want it, so that's fine. Like, I don't like shaking hands with strangers and things like that, and I think that's healthy. I don't see why I should. Why would I want to? And, but I certainly noticed when I was falling for a woman here or there, I mean, throughout my life, how difficult it was for me just to, you know, have a kind of physical affection that wasn't loaded. Just a natural way of being, you know, affectionate physically. Well, I didn't have it. It didn't come naturally to me, and I became aware of what an obstacle that was in terms of, let's say, seduction, for lack of a better term.
Well, with your family, what about your siblings? Did you ever hug your brother or sister that much?
My sister's very huggy, touchy, feely. She's also, however, very, I would say, she's very emotional, and she's very, like, she prioritizes emotions in a way that I don't. It's why the autist tag fit me quite well. Mm-hmm. No, I don't think I'm a cold fish at all, and I don't think many people think that if they know me.
Yeah.
But I don't like, I mean, I'll express anger and stuff. I'm not saying I am actually quite an emotionally charged person. But in terms of affection, let's say that's what we're talking about, I prefer if it's quiet. I don't like big, messy, sloppy. Yeah. Well, that's probably partly because my mother went to both extremes. She could be cold as ice, or she could be drunken all over me, you know, which was horrible too.
No happy medium.
Very little happy medium, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's unfortunate. You know, it's hard for me to, even to this day, to fathom that, because I was just never been around that growing up.
You never felt the cold rage of a parent?
No.
And you never felt smothered by either one?
Maybe sometimes I felt that for my mother. Definitely not my father. Hmm. But it was not really intrusive into my life. Like it is, you know, some parents are very intrusive in their child's life, just projecting themselves immediately into whatever they do, everything.
Absolutely, yeah. Do you feel that you received your father's blessing? If you know, do you know that concept, the father's blessing?
Yeah.
Do you feel that you received that, or that you were denied that?
I think so, because neither of my parents ever impeded what it is I wanted to do. But I also had a sense of what was appropriate, what was not appropriate, what was feasible, what was infeasible to do. And I think a lot of that came from the senses that my mother was deprived this growing up because she had a cold and distant father. So I think she went in the other direction, is that she was never going to do this to both of her kids, because I have a sister that's 12 years older than I am, which it also explains a separate dynamic, because she and I don't have a relationship. Partially because of her personality, but also because of the age difference, because we're, in effect, two separate generations.
Yeah, she would have been like a second mother then, if she was interested, or was she not?
Well, from what I can tell, and I see the pictures, is that my sister was a secondary mother when I was a baby. Mm. But then she married and was out of the house by the time I was 9 or 10. Hmm. So there wasn't that chance to develop a kind of strong sibling relationship, also abstending sibling rivalry. And then she became like another relative that you visited. I only saw her once every couple of weeks and on the holidays type of thing. Hmm.
So, but were you saying you feel you did receive your father's blessing, or you didn't, because it wasn't clear?
I did.
You did. So you felt that he, at some point, he looked at you and figuratively, literally said, "Tim, I'm proud of you. You've turned out just right, or good
Yes.
egg, or whatever." Yeah. Okay. Because
he might not have verbalized it, but in his behavior, and my mom always noticed this too. It says, you know, your dad's very proud of you, what you've done, and what you've become.
Yeah, well, that's very important, I think. I mean, and the younger the better, because I might have got some of it in my 30s when I got published or something, but it was too little too late.
You were just I mean, I have to ask the question, Jason, is that, you know, what were you to your parents? What were your brother and sister to your parents? Accessories? Furniture? Something to brag about?
Inconveniences a lot. I'm not sure if there was much status in it. Comfort objects. Less my sister, because I think both my mother... Well, my mother wanted a boy, or it doesn't matter what she wanted, actually, because she wanted a girl when I was born. But I mean, she particularly enmeshed with her boys as surrogate husbands. So that's the answer for my mother. She wanted a kind of love object for herself. So there wasn't indifference on my mother's part, except the kind of cold indifference of a woman who's spurned, who's angry. Which obviously is not healthy. Not that indifference is ever healthy, but and in my father's case, well, that was something we grew up aware of, because we never called him father. He wouldn't let us call him dad. He never wanted to have children. He just went along with it. Well, he was very into sex, and he didn't like condoms. He used to joke how it was like eating a toffee with the wrapper on. So he probably would have inevitably ended up having children just, you know, as a result of doing what he wanted. And certainly he didn't say no. I don't think my mother was ever encouraged to have an abortion or anything like that. But no, it seemed to me he didn't feel responsible for us. He didn't feel like he had a responsibility to us. He gave us a bunch of money. That was the expression of his care, really.
So he was cavalier, indifferent, and thoughtless.
Yes, I mean, there were many other adjectives that would fit, and they're not all bad. He was a lost soul, as the summation of it, who hated his own father, so really didn't want to see himself as a father. And by the time I came along, he was estranged from my mother, and another fella was on his way in anyway. So, I think, you know, a parent can't fail to love their child, because even biology takes care of that. But it doesn't mean they're able to express it or even experience it. It's just kind of there in the biology.
Right. It's the biological form of love, but we humans are something more than biology.
There's a much deeper dimension, and I think by the time I came along, my father had lost touch with that. He'd literally lost the use of his legs, or was rather beginning to lose the use of his legs, and that loss of ground, I think, corresponded with his loss of soul. So he didn't... I felt like my father, I wrote this in Prisoner Infinity, I think, was like the man on the stair who is not there. It was like when I would look to him, it was like there was this smoke screen saying, "Don't look at me," and it was painful to look at him in many ways, because he really didn't want to be seen by his children. I think
he's trying to dissolve into the woodwork.
And you said woodwork, but into his work as well.
Diving into his work, which seems a very stereotypically male thing.
Yes, indeed.
Okay, so going to the next page, 88, he does spend a little bit of time in the next paragraphs comparing Western society to the Japanese society. Well, just flipping back to 87, I'll go to the second paragraph. He says, let us take the Japanese case first. In Japan, the primary emphasis on child rearing centers on the first 3 years of life. Indeed, the Japanese have a special word for this period, referring to it as ajaisik, thereby avoiding the loaded pre-theological term, pre-Oedipal. A Japanese saying has it that the soul of the three-year-old lasts till 100, hence the crucial importance of this formative period. Okay. Then on the next page, page 88, he says, one thing we see is that despite the centrality of the biological mother-infant tie, cultural expectations begin to shape the infant by the third month of life. One study of 30 Japanese and 30 American infants found that preferred patterns of social interaction were unconsciously imposed by the mothers from the moment that their children were born. Mm. True to form, Japanese mothers spent a great deal of time with their infants, emphasized physical over verbal interaction, and had a passive, contented baby as their goal. In general, a Japanese child will sleep with its parents until 10 years of age. In the United States, the infant typically sleeps alone shortly after birth.
Yeah.
Whereas the American model is that of seeing the infant as a dependent organism that needs to become independent in order to mature, the Japanese regard the infant as a separate organism who needs, from birth, to be drawn into interdependent relations. Thus, mother-child symbiosis is pathology in New York, health in Tokyo. While the American mother typically looks at her baby and chats with it, the Japanese mother carries, rocks, and soothes it.
Yeah, it's a very interesting, challenging passage, isn't it? How profound cultural differences are, and is it biology, you know, which comes first? Because it's epigenetics, isn't it? But I knew somebody who married a Japanese, and when I found out that they slept with their child, who was more than seven, I don't remember how old he was, and even had sex while he was in the bed, I was... I was pretty shocked. And even more personal direct experience, when I, on the periphery of my niece's growing up, because her father died when she was only two, I believe, very young. So I was the primary male caregiver, although I was only around for a couple of weeks a year most times, so I was always traveling, but I certainly was around every year for her. I mean, not expressly for her, but that was one of the reasons, and we had a very strong bond, we have and had. One of the things I really objected to was how my sister would sleep with her and let her sleep with her even into her teens, and I just felt it was very unhealthy, and that was a symptom of a larger this mother-child symbiosis that was quite extreme in the case of my sister and my niece, and I thought it was going to lead to disastrous results, as it hasn't thus far. Like, my niece is an adult now, and she's quite remarkable and pretty grounded and very healthy and sane and sensible, and so no obvious deleterious effects from no dangerously evident effects from that. So it certainly forced me to reconsider my views about that. But I still don't know. I mean, it's not necessarily either or, is it, in terms of this? Either is it psychosis, or is it pathology, or is it healthy? It's a very interesting, the totally opposite viewpoints that he describes there, of that the Japanese see the infant as separate and feel it needs to be bonded, whereas we view it as bonded and needs to be separated.
Yeah. In my own case, I was put in a crib.
Yeah.
But my room was very close to my parents' room. I also remember occasionally when I was a kid that I would sleep with my parents. If I had a nightmare or there was a storm outside or something like that, it wasn't common. I slept in my own bed, but nearby. So, you know, going back to my earlier point is that when I went to school with my mother, I just went with my mother. It wasn't I was going somewhere that was separate from my mother. And at home, I was near my parents all the time. When I was sleeping, when I woke up in the morning, you know, if I was in the living room watching TV, they were always nearby, type of thing. You know, I certainly wasn't a free range child, as they like to call it, where at 6 or 7 years old, I'm off doing things myself. type of thing. That I would not have even thought that at the time. Plus, it probably wasn't. That's not the kind of thing I think I would encourage any parents to do. That just let the child go off at 6 or 7 to do whatever it is they want.
Yeah, that sounds more like me. And although I don't think I went very far afield at that young age, I certainly was always going off and being on my own. That was something I grew up hearing. Oh, you always, as a child, you would just go off and do your own thing from a very young age. Well, no wonder.
Yeah, you were really trying to get away from that. Of course, I was doing, you know, excursions going back, but it's like it's, you know, you're like a scout. You leave the tribe, you go out, you do your thing, and then you come back, and you're welcome back. Then you go off and you do something else, and then you come back. Mm. It's not the subconscious means to just get away entirely from a toxic situation.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So skipping to page 91, again in the same section, Berman says, what emerges from all this is a kind of biocultural constant, is A, the primacy of females as caregivers. There are a few contemporary rare exceptions to this. And again, B, the primacy of physical non-Western cultures, especially hunter-gatherer cultures. And probably in the West until the High Middle Ages, when the cradle was introduced in Europe, inaugurating the regular separation of infants from adults.
The cradle.
The cradle.
Yeah.
Yes. The world norm is for the infant to be on or near the mother, or a female caregiver day and night. And this was very likely the Paleolithic as well. Dr. Spock and other child care experts have typically been concerned that all of this early physical holding promotes dependency. But just the opposite has proven to be the case. Interference with early somatic needs and the imposition of autonomy before a child can handle it creates a sense of absence where there should be a primary experience of relationship. In effect, if one gets punished or reproved for being human, what will result is a perversive sense of anxiety, confusion, false independence, and often hidden overdependence. Miss these early phases holding, and you remain caught in dependency needs forever. In such a world, domination and hierarchy become very attractive, natural, and the human condition.
Yeah. And in such a world, of course, because of those values, those hierarchical values, we get somebody like Dr. Spock, who's encouraging autonomy and independence and achievement and a certain value set. And this is the way to foment it, or whatever the word is, foment it. And it's, well, Sparta's coming to mind. I mean, there's a tradition of hardship building character and creating individuals who will achieve great things is throughout Western culture.
Yeah. But also a key term that's earlier is the promotion of interdependence, which I've seen before, and the older I get, the more that I really subscribe more to interdependence, because nobody is truly independent. With the way, you know, kind of extrapolating from what Berman says here, is that this push to be supremely independent sets up a brittle person, because they're not really independent. They think they are, but they're also relying on others that they don't acknowledge, or they seek to dominate because of something, of some kind of trauma that happened in the first months up to the first few years of life. And so to reach a sense of centeredness or wholeness, you could even say, they feel they have to dominate others. They're just racked with anxiety.
Yeah, he's written about Shane, because I quoted it in Maps of Hell, and how the character of Shane is just a total anomaly or an abomination. Even if it were to try and translate it into real human existence, it'd be like an alien, this wanderer who's just completely isolate like a star, and dependent on no one, and, you know, never settles down, because the movie The Searchers did show how the core of that character is this loneliness and alienation, self-loathing even. And but this It's also, I look at this in 60 Mats of Hell, that the updating of this, it's kind of an American ideal really, isn't it? But the solar hero, whatever we're going to call that, the truly independent man is the superhero. And it's pointed out, it's been pointed out how superheroes often has all this technology and stuff that we don't see how it's built. It's actually, it would take hundreds if not thousands of laborers to build, you know, the Batcave or the Fortress of Solitude is Superman, so that's different. But and that's all hidden. So that's like the hidden slave force that really this idea of this independent man needs. Right? It's a complete illusion, and hence you got the psychodynamic is that in order to have that kind of autonomy or sovereignty, is the trendy word for it, you have to be oppressing a multitude.
Right. Or even touching on something that you brought up, an important figure in life, in your life, about Clint Eastwood's characters.
Yeah.
So the, you know, putting aside Dirty Harry for a minute, the man with no name in the trilogy,
yeah,
where, like in The Good and the Bad and the Ugly, perfect example is that Blondie, the character he plays, is really not that savory a character, even though he is kind of the good guy compared to Angel Eyes and Tuco. But Tuco seems more of the, when you look at it, Tuco seems more of the
human.
He's more he's more human. He's more sympathetic because he also has a backstory.
Yeah.
Angel Eyes and Blondie, they don't have a backstory.
That's right. Yeah, well, you might want to read my Secret Life of Movies on Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, because I deconstruct the alchemical text of that movie in this way. And one of the things I observe or realize while writing it is that what the movie's showing is that he only becomes the good by the end. He's absolutely not the good at the beginning. So he is on this journey. And part of it is actually a journey away from isolation to, because these other, the other characters represent parts of his own psyche that he has to integrate. So he's only able to become whole through this interaction with others. And that's even, it didn't occur to me, but that's even in the trilogy, as in he becomes less solitary with each film. First of all, he's alone, then there's two characters, and then there's three. So there's something in that.
So would you consider the three movies of a piece? He's more or less the same character in each three?
We're supposed to be. It's just not. I mean, the irony is, of course, The Man with No Name was invented afterwards by American advertisers, and he has a name in all the films. It's a different name. So I think the myth kind of grew out of the, you know, the artifacts without necessarily being intentional on the part of the filmmakers. But now it's this single character.
Mm-hmm. What was your take on some of his other westerns? Josie Wales and Unforgiven, High Plains Drifter.
Well,
because he's kind of playing the same character in those movies too.
Well, he is and he isn't, because it's the medium and the message and all that. So, and this maybe just brings us back to the core point, which is there's no independence, that a character can't exist separately from the world around him. So although you could say, well, Clint Eastwood took The Man with No Name and then relocated him in High Plains Drifter, it doesn't really work. It's a comment on those films and that character in some way, and it refers back to them, but it's not, one can't repeat it in that way. So for me, there's something, I mean, after all the years of me loving Clint Eastwood, discovering him as The Man with No Name, all the way to the point where I realise actually he's not that great after all, is he? To this present day, for me, it's The Fistful of Dollars is the one I always want to come back to, or Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. I mean, they're both great movies, but that the first character he ever really embodied to me was the moment that lightning was captured, and after that it was all kind of a distortion of it, or a bottling of it, or something, like a reproducing of something. It doesn't have that pure essence to me that The Man with No Name concept had. And again, trying to get it back to the real topic, in Fistful of Dollars, in a certain sense, even more. I mean, in Good, the Mad, and the Ugly, my view is he becomes good when he discovers compassion, which is at the end, right before they discover the gold, he's seen with a kitten, and he's stroking the kitten, and he's talking to the kitten. That's why
He gives the cigar to the dying soldier.
That's right. And after that, he gives the cigar to the dying soldier, and that's when he takes the poncho from the dying soldier because he doesn't want to take his coat off him because he's dead and he respects the dead. So then he says, okay, I'll take the poncho instead. And that's when he becomes the man with no name. You could even say that was pre-Fistful of Dollars if you wanted to get fancy about it. But to us, it's only when he puts the poncho on that we're like, aha. Now he's the man with no name. And then, of course, the whole final thing is about no name. It's a grave with no name. It's a stone with no name on it. There's something going on here about the true self is no, there's no identity to it. And that's the only good. The only goodness we can really achieve is if we let go of our own identifications and so on. But why was I saying all this? That in Fistful of Dollars, he seems like he is a self-driven individual. He's just there to make money. But the turning point, the thing that gets him in trouble, is he uses all his resources and he gives all his money to that family. So it turns out that despite himself, he becomes a hero. He's there opportunistically, but then he sees somebody who's in the same trouble that he was once in. He's very obscure about it. And there was no one there to help. Like, why are you helping us? Because I knew someone like you once and there was no one there to help. So probably it's him he's talking about. And he's trying to make the past right by doing the right thing in the present. So he saves that family from the bandits. And as a result, he gives away all his money and he gets captured and he gets brutalized. And so actually he's not. It's interesting, you know, how these myths, they kind of reveal something despite themselves in some way, maybe. He's not really that independent. He's aware that his responsibility is to others, to the family, even to the child. And that's not, so I don't know if that's, I was going to say, I'm not sure how well that is comes out in the later films.
In a perfect world, I'd be your girl. I'd see your eyes from a mile away. I'd run into your arms and knock you down. In a less than perfect world, I'd be yours. If the timing wasn't right, then I'll fall asleep tonight. I'll try again tomorrow and I just might. Who would've thought I'd be fussing with flowers? Who would've thought I'd be missing those showers? It's not what you think. It's not what you think you want. It's not what you think. It's not what you think at all. In a perfect world, I'd be your girl. I'd see your eyes from a mile away. I'd run into your arms and knock you down. In a less than perfect world, I'd be yours. When I catch you in my side, oh, I'll steal another bite. Savor that and taste with a slow and steady pace. Who would've thought it'd be me you devour? Who would've thought I'd relinquish all power? It's not what you think. It's not what you think you want. It's not what you think. It's not what you think at all. It's not what you think. No, it's not what you think you want. It's not what you think. It's not what you think you want. It's not what you think. It's not what you think you want. No, it's not what you think. It's not what you think you want. It's not what you think. No, it's not what you think you want. It's not what you think. It's not what you think you want. It's not what you think. It's not what you think.
Yeah, well, I wanted to just quickly go back to Shane. So it's been a long time since I last saw The Searchers, and I'm fuzzy on the details. So Shane is held up as the paragon of the independent hero, maybe you could even say anti-hero given what he does, but this
No, he's a hero, yeah. The anti-hero is when they started shooting people in the back and things like that, whereas Shane at least plays it square, fair and square.
Okay, but yeah. But there's more of a sense of, I guess in your estimation, there's more of a sense of interdependence in the trilogy versus the Shane character in Searchers.
Well, because the Shane thing ends with him riding off and the boy going, come back, Shane, come back, and there's no way. Like, it's so central to him being Shane is that he couldn't settle down. Now, yeah. You could say, well, the man with no name wouldn't settle down too, and he rides away, that's true. And so, and Shane does save the community. So they're similar, but I mean that in the man with no name, Fistful of Dollars, that was his grungy realism, and that was the anti-hero. And yet we see that he does good, but he's still the anti-hero. Whereas Shane, it's sort of the other way around. He's the hero, and yet we see that he's kind of detached and, you know, unreal, unnatural, but we're still supposed to think he's the hero. That's the example of a good masculinity.
Yeah, and that's always been my estimation of the anti-hero. They do good in spite of themselves.
And somehow it's more real good. I mean, I think the anti-hero has become something horrible. I mean, obviously, yeah. There's Hannibal Lecter. It's ended up somewhere awful. But I think the kernel of the positive in it is, and I think this is in Berman, actually, that about the boss, the chief who has no power, that somehow we can only really do good by not trying to do good, sort of despite ourselves. Bit like you're saying, love in action. Like if we act lovingly, not because we want something or because we're trying to be loving, but because love moves us despite ourselves and things happen. So I think there's an element of that. Certainly there's an appeal in seeing a character who seems to be self-serving, but when it comes to the crunch, something in him takes over and is stronger.
Okay, so skipping to page 92. Yeah. This is non-dyadic childbearing.
Okay.
So I'll go ahead for the first couple paragraphs, lots of this one.
Okay.
So Berman says, in terms of cultural modifications, it turns out that strictly dyadic mothering is once again the exception than the rule. Monotropy would seem to be a European pattern, one that weakens in multiple caregiver situations. Data from Uganda, for example, reveal that the mother-infant bond is weaker in proportion to the number of people in the household. This is the common pattern in worldwide terms. And in addition, in such context, infants and toddlers tend not to have attachments to transitional objects. The availability of other people mediates the nature of maternal care, and we would have to conclude the dyadic energy pattern as well. It may also be the case that attachment figures at a certain point in a child's development may be fairly interchangeable, indicating some degree of pliability in this area. Thus, Mary Ainsworth notes that some research has demonstrated that a baby may become attached to several caregivers before, at the same time as, or shortly after it becomes attached to its mother. She also notes that too many attachment figures work against the formation of attachment to any one figure, the pattern of the Israeli kibbutz. But she argues that in general, spreading the attachment over several figures may be healthy and adaptive. So this is more fleshing out the earlier point you mentioned about Ainsworth. Okay, in the next paragraph, he says, narcissism, of course, which Philip Slater says is characteristic of the steep gradient personality, begins at home. And conversely, so does the more diffuse, community-oriented personality. Two factors, which tend to go together, make the latter possible. Multiple caregiving and having the infant on the periphery rather than at the center of adult activities. This pattern is especially true of hunter-gatherer societies. Thus, while the mother-infant bond among the Kung Bushmen is close and of long duration, it also exists within a dense social context. And by age 3 or 4, the infant graduates from this strong bond with the mother to a multi-age child group. Melissa Heckler, who spent some time living among the Kung, reports how, by 6 months of age, the Kung infant could, quote, be found on the hips of anyone who happened to wander by. It was less clear to a visitor who the mother was. Nurturing is provided by all and sundry, male and female, end quote. In this society, the infant is passed from one adult to another. To be held and played with, Hence the oft-quoted African proverb, it takes an entire village to raise a child.
Yeah. Well, once again, very little mention of the father. I don't think there was a single mention of the father in either of those passages, so that stood out for me. The other thing that occurred to me was a bit dark, but this idea of a child being passed around through, you know, various adults has very dark connotations in our culture,
right.
As in, you know, sex trafficking or pimping out children, which we know happens. So I just wondered if, because many of, it seems like many of the distortions we have, the social pathologies are, you know, shadows of something real, like we're unconsciously trying to act something out that is instinctive and healthy, and so there could be an overlap between, and this may be a reach and it may take us too far off track, but the idea that sexual abuse is good for children because it gives them a drive to survive and an ambition and so on, this trauma genesis thing, and the overlap between these two things, that actually for a child not to be bonded too much to a single parent or to its parents, and to be, because in our present society it's very hard to imagine having the level of trust where we would just let a small child be handed to just about any adult, not even know where they were, you know, at a certain point. So it just indicates how far we are from that we've potentially even come to a very dark, distorted mirror image of that.
Well, of course, the things that stand out to me is, if you're talking about primitive societies, like, for lack of a better term, it's a better quality control. So yeah. Any kind of pathologies probably either wouldn't exist or very much muted, or if they did arise, then those people would have been pushed out of the tribe a long time ago, not allowed, because they're inimical to the tribe's survival. Why would you allow a predator within your own tribe, type of thing?
This is an interesting question, because there's an anecdote I've heard from my wife, because she knows a fair bit about native communities here on reservations and whatnot, and that she said that if there's a child abuser in the community, they can't really do anything about it, because except try and protect the children, but in terms of retribution, because it can just start a cycle of violence. So if they kill that guy or beat him up, then his relatives will come and kill somebody else and so on. So it's definitely delicate. I mean, there's a delicate balance there. How do you deal with the predator in the midst? If you can't just kill him, can you ostracize him, as you're suggesting? Because that might be death. That might also be the equivalent to death. But so anyway, I just put that as a counterpoint. It's not always that straightforward. If you have that element, that you can just say, well, obviously we've got to get rid of it, because of this interdependence thing.
Right, but also, you know, I don't know much about Native American culture. I certainly have heard enough about pathologies that exist on reservations: alcoholism, drug abuse, sexual abuse. But what Berman is describing here, quoting the anthropologist, these are primitive societies compared to modern day Native Americans that have lived on reservations, which themselves are natural, and so far removed centuries from what they were like in North America.
Yeah, so relatively healthy is what you're thinking. Assuming.
Right, well, relatively healthy. And yes, you have an interesting point, is that because the Native Americans are on the reservation so much more tightly knit than Anglos are, we'll say, than the wider society, that there's there are ups and downs with that, good points and bad points. The good point is they have a better sense of cohesion, but the bad point is that it's far more difficult to extirpate any kind of dysfunctions, be it a sexual predator or if alcoholism tears its way through the reservation, or if they become so dependent on something like casinos to bring money into the reservation, type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
That invites a whole raft of problems that they really have difficulty overcoming.
Mm-hmm. All right, so accepting that we're talking about prehistorical communities, even where there isn't too much predation, we're still accepting that it may exist. And in fact, when and how things went wrong presumably was related to this. So this spectrum between healthy child rearing and what I brought up, which is child predation, that is a spectrum, isn't it? As in, it doesn't just go from good child rearing to bad child rearing, it goes all the way to eating children, etc., and raping them. And the eating and raping of children also goes very far back. That's prehistorical too, or at least the eating of them. I'm not so confident about the raping.
Something else that he mentions later on is infanticide.
Yes.
Was more common in ancient societies than it is.
Yeah, really important point, really key point. Because, I mean, just to get to it now, and we can then go back to where we are, but that if it's possible, I don't know how much he really makes this question, that the harmony that we're imagining or positing about hunter-gatherer societies, or even early communities, somewhat depended on infanticide, which to us would be the worst possible thing, like anything to get that out of the mix.
Right. Yeah. Right. But in a certain sense, it kind of makes sense, because if you adopt a mindset of, again, for lack of a better term, quality control, you don't permit any kind of what we would consider oddities, now that's putting it mildly and somewhat charitably, within the tribe, because they're no good to the tribe. I do remember hearing snatches here and there about, like, in the Inuit in particular, what they do with psychopaths. Anybody that manifested that kind of behavior, you send them on an ice floe, trying to trick them to do that, because you just want to remove that from the tribe.
But you see how easy that could backfire, no?
Sure.
As in the psychopath starts saying, it's a psychopath, put him on an ice floe.
Right. Yeah, hunter-gatherer societies weren't perfect, but the certain things that are often not talked about that we in the modern world would consider abhorrent, like infanticide. If the child is not destined to live, or it's going to require a lot more resources just to keep it alive, you're better off to leave it.
Yeah, or even if there's too many children, as it is in the animal kingdom,
right?
Then the weak one gets eaten.
Right. Okay. Okay. So let's see. Okay, on page 94, Berman continues. What Western or urban children get is a child rearing pattern that is atypical on a world scale and then amounts to a double whammy. This is not to say that the multiple caregiving pattern is problem-free or that it creates perfect societies. Far from it. But if we are focusing on the issue of basic trust and psychic stability, it is clear whence the drivenness and pervasive malaise of narcissistic cultures originate. With a lack of very much somatic holding and a caregiver pattern that is dyadic and exclusive, we get an adult who is typically brittle and high-strung. The, quote, center of gravity is too high. Such a zero-sum personality, all-or-nothing psychology, is largely erected around fear, around a hole, one might say. And this is why object relations is particularly accurate in its description of the contemporary Western personality. And although some degree of fear and alienation is always present in the human psyche, this non-somatic dyadic pattern creates a tremendous need for hierarchy to generate pseudo-stability. It doesn't work very well, of course. Domination produces a chain reaction without end, and this has a parallel in the outside world.
Okay.
Nothing more to add?
Nothing to add. I'm just thinking of time and how many pages we have now, so...
Well, okay, so I will skip. He talks about kibbutzes. Okay. Let's see. Okay, so then, just quickly on page 101, in the section of birth spacing and population growth. So his first sentence is, The issues of child rearing practices, accumulation and storage, which we touched on earlier, dominance and insecurity, and so on, are all closely intertwined with the factor of birth spacing and population growth. This is also something that shows up as a contrast between sedentary versus nomadic life and points to the biological and demographic constraints that limit human choices with respect to social values and corresponding adult-infant patterns of interacting. Population growth leads to complexity, and as Barry, Child, and Bacon discovered, this evokes a different set of values and corresponding child-rearing practices than those found in simpler situations. So what he's touching on here is from an earlier point about sedentary societies moving from the immediate return, which was hunter-gatherer societies, to the delayed return, which is more characteristic of agricultural sedentary societies, mm-hmm. that because you're sat in one place and you have a more of abundance of food, the population explodes as a consequence.
Yeah.
And when that happens, then the birth spacing. So hunter-gatherers, they had, as it goes on later in the book, is that they spaced their children much further apart of a few years. So you, as a hunter-gatherer woman, you wouldn't want to have to carry two infants with you, or an infant and a 1 or 2 year old child. It just would slow you down, and that opens you up to predation, quite possibly. So it would not be uncommon to have a 3 or 4 year old and an infant on the woman's back. So there's a greater space that's there.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, this, the central question of a people that's in movement can't grow too large or is unlikely to grow past a certain point versus one that's sedentary, I think is really interesting.
Right. And in sedentary societies, even like 100 years ago, you would have large families on a farm. That's it. And hunter-gatherers would not have had such a large family of 10 kids or so. My father, for example, he came from a family of 7 kids.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, something I said a while back, I tweeted or something, which is once something becomes a movement, it ceases to move. And what I meant was, you know, once certain ideas or values or ways of doing things get fixed into some sort of ideology, then that's it. It's dead, because it's not moving, it's not changing, can't adapt. And this thing of space that he's describing there, I mean, he's talking about space in time, isn't he? Actually, the space he's talking about is time. But there would also, of course, be a question of space that would become an issue once people were settled and were growing, as we're seeing on the planetary level now. The whole notion of, is there enough space, or do I personally have enough space, becomes relevant. Whereas when you're on the move, there's nothing but terrain, essentially.
Right. The world was far less populated in ancient times, so if you had roving bands of hunter-gatherers, lots of space.
Yeah. So I'm wondering if there's something about, and this would be a bit radical, but anyway, about that a human organism, a collective human organism, as in an organism made up of many humans, if we can posit that, a tribe, a band, is only really able to live, just as the human body is only able to be fully alive if it's flowing, if blood's flowing, if it's moving. If there's something about when a band stops and gets organized that allows a kind of rigor mortis to set in some way. And paradoxically, it starts to grow,
right?
Which you'd think would be a sign of life, but maybe it's just not.
Well, depending. I mean, there certainly is, one could say, life in frenetic activity. One can't sit still, even though one is in a sedentary society. So you're out driving somewhere, you're walking, or participating in all kinds of activities just because you can't sit still. But you're doing that to try to mollify, to assuage and diminish the feelings of anxiety you feel if you're sitting all alone, lost with your thoughts.
Yeah.
But that the feelings that you have of anxiety, tying back to what he's already said before, is about child rearing and the society produces the kind of individuals it wants. It's all connected.
So, and the other thing I was wondering about was for people to organize themselves in motion is much more difficult than when they're sedentary. And particularly with numbers, like the more numbers, the more complex it becomes. So even if you're sedentary, you break into little different neighborhoods and stuff. So, but if humans have the capacity of other animals to move as a herd, like birds in murmuration, if there is that faculty for us to organize in motion, we would lose that faculty when we settled. Like birds can't murmurate unless they're flying,
right? Or to bring movies into this, disaster films. So, if a city comes under attack, like it's a nuclear destruction, and you have bands of people that are streaming out from the city, they're on the move, and then they find others that are also in movement. And then what happens? They band together, or they're moving away from, also maybe moving to something. There's a safe haven that they're moving towards. And you know, I haven't watched a whole lot of movies that where this theme plays out, but I always seem to remember is that there's far less problems when the people are on the move. When they settle down somewhere, then they start picking at each other.
It's in The Walking Dead as well, I think, isn't it? They get along okay while they're roving, but once they find a stronghold, then the hierarchy starts to establish itself.
Right. Yeah. So that seems to underscore your point, is that when you're on the move, you have less problems.
I had another one, but it's gone, so let's just dive into the next text.
Okay, so quickly on page 104, he says, overpopulation wreaks havoc, violates the biopsychic basis of human life. The abandonment of an infant is not necessarily the same thing as callousness, so referring to infanticide here. Studies among Eskimo, for example, revealed that the children who were allowed to live were dearly loved. The problem of defining infanticide is similar to defining the beginning of life in the abortion debate. In most societies, it takes place before the infant has the status of a real person. Among contemporary cultures, at least, ethnographic research makes it clear that infanticide, as in the case of the Kum, is never taken lightly and done only when it makes adaptive sense. As in the abortion debate, we have to ask whether the proliferation of unwanted and abused children is the better choice. He continues, the point remains that the human biological inheritance is designed for a higher quality of life than that provided by agricultural civilization with its early weaning and traumatic treatment of infants. So infanticide is never taken lightly. That was the point.
Are you a parent?
No.
So I couldn't remember if I knew this or not, but it seemed like I didn't, and now I do. So we're at a disadvantage, both of us, aren't we? Right? Mm-hmm. Around this, I mean.
Yeah. Although I think not being a parent provides one with a certain advantage, a standpoint, to observe how parents are.
Well, this is true. Although I say, you know, it's better to have been rich and poor and then in between to really have a spectrum. So, but one can't really have been a parent and not been a parent. It's kind of either or, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I do feel I have the ability to see parenting more objectively than most parents seem to see it. But then I probably would think that. But anyway, this is what we're talking about, aren't we, here, that a very objective approach to difficult realities. So it's not necessarily like killing a child isn't necessarily a measure of the lack of love for that child.
Right. Now, something I forgot to mention earlier is that reading Berman, it was more the case in ancient societies that they practiced infanticide, something which the Western world would never think to do. Certainly not publicly.
Well, not publicly, and except for abortion, yeah.
Yeah. However, in the case of abortion, or giving a child up for adoption or taking a child to an orphanage. Now, you know the story about orphanages, what they used to be like back in the day. You could easily home in on Charles Dickens, Oliver. Mm-hmm. What kind of people are produced in orphanages? Not mm-hmm. very healthy or well-adjusted ones.
No, and terrible, like a hunting ground for predators to this day. It probably hasn't changed in terms of that Dickensian view of, you know, child abusers running orphanages.
Right. Or in the worst cases, like the Romanian orphanages where the children were never held.
Yeah.
Type of thing.
Yeah, so I mean, we have this, I think it's a schizophrenia, isn't it, our society, isn't it, that we have this idea that life is sacred mm-hmm. in some way, but the result of it isn't a real nurturing of life.
No, it's almost like it's life at all costs, regardless yeah. of the costs or the consequences from that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but then on the other hand, there's the pro-choice thing. You know, we allow abortion.
Exactly. So, but that's like that's a double think, I would say. Like, because we've convinced ourselves that the fetus isn't really a person, then we don't have to even think about it.
Right.
Well, many West. I mean, I didn't think about it for 20 or even 30 years very deeply, because I just grew up with that value. Of course, abortion should be legal.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we don't really know the objective facts really, about what's happening, what's dying, and what's... Yeah.
Right. Okay, so then I'm moving to page 108, the urge toward transcendence, this section.
Page what?
Page 108.
Okay.
Okay, so Berman says, among hunter-gatherers for whom occasional infanticide notwithstanding, the quality of nurturance is probably the best unitive trance and religion, quote religion, may exist occasionally, but for the most part they are superfluous. Secure in the world already, these immediate return cultures tend to entertain charismatic behavior, mostly under conditions of stress. Their child-rearing pattern on multiple caregiving means that individuals are raised with a diffuse energy pattern. Their vertical needs are much less, and they grow up with a focus on life itself, not on God or an afterlife. Hunter-gatherers typically do not generate prophets or guru figures. The quote, sacred is simply that which is present in front of them. To be alive, to participate in life in the here and now, is worship for these cultures. And then it continues. In the case of the sacred authority complex, and in particular of unitive trance, we should recall Erickson's comments on the, quote, numinous experience that an infant in a dyadic relation will have of its mother. By trying to recapture this experience later in life through things such as religion or immersion in the leader's charisma, the individual obtains a sense of transcending his or her separateness.
Boris Berman is Jewish, isn't he?
Yes.
Because earlier when we were talking about humans in murmuration, and I lost some point there, I don't know if it's going to come back, but one of the things that occurred to me was, oh, is this what the thing with the Jews is about? Because they were all about, they only became the Jews in the way that they're identified today because of that, you know, the pilgrimage, the exodus out of Egypt and to the promised land. So they're a wandering people, and they were a wandering people, well, until Israel, essentially.
Yeah.
And now look what they've become. They've become, you know, Israelis.
Yeah.
But let's not go there.
However, if I could interject, I once knew a guy years ago who was raised Jewish, and he said he argued with a wealthy New York area liberal Jew, and he told her straight out, he said, my identity as a Jew is not dependent on the state of Israel.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was being glib. Obviously Berman isn't an Israelite, and he's probably not pro-Israel even, because he's pretty savvy. So I was being glib, but with a point, or at least a question. Does Berman, he doesn't talk about the Abrahamic religion and the Jews in this book much, does he? But it seems that would be quite a thing to put under the microscope for his thesis, in terms of what becomes of a nomad people when they become sedentary, or perhaps, or even, like, what is it about the Jews that makes them the Jews? Because clearly they have a very, very strong cultural identity, or genetic identity, or whatever we're going to call it, strongest on the planet, I would say. And they're very unified, even if they're spread across the planet. There's a kind of unity of, it's the only religion that's genetic, if we could say, etc. So does that, is there any relation between that and their being a wandering people, and the, anyway, more to the point of the passage you just read, the inception of the hierarchical religion, the sacred authority complex in the Western world today is with Abraham and the patriarchs, who were wanderers, who were nomads, but then then they settled.
I think you bring up an interesting point, is because the Jews for so long were a wandering people, they would fit somewhat into this hunter-gatherer mold. But I know more about Christianity than I do about Judaism, but Judaism is quite distinct from Christianity, despite the Judeo-Christian moniker that emerged sometime in the early part of the 20th century, just to emphasize this kind of continuity. Now, the Jews are different than Christians. And there is something of the sacred authority complex, because they do believe in Yahweh, the God with whom the nation of Israel has a covenant. But something else that, you know, Vox Dei in particular has pointed out is the thing about the ethnoi in the Bible, the nation, not a nation state, but a nation in terms of a people. And the Jews have been persecuted for so long, so there's that outside pressure that's forcing them to stay together to survive. And that's very tribal, hunter-gatherer, because they're on the move type of thing. But the way they approach things in Judaism, like, for example, there's really no sense of an afterlife, as it would be in a Christian heaven afterlife.
Yeah, I was going to say that,
Yeah, so that, I think that still retains, depending on, you know, whatever flavor of Judaism you're talking about. But on a slightly different tack is Zygmunt Bauman, whom I mentioned before, a Polish sociologist who himself was a Jew, wrote one of his well-known books, Modernity and the Holocaust, about modernity's effect upon the Jew, where then they became, they still kind of fit into that wandering, but when you're talking about modernity, which is like 16th, 17th, 18th century, then they start to become a little bit more settled in their communities. So then you have Dutch Jews and French Jews and German Jews and things like that. So then they start to become absorbed more into the nation state and identifying, leaving behind their Jewishness and becoming more of what that is. And then some Jews who converted, you know, maybe they were born Jews, or certain figures who were born from a Jewish family but then converted to Protestantism because that was advantageous to them. Now, that's what happened to Marx's family. That's what happened to Felix Mendelssohn's family.
Mm.
Yeah, an interesting take on that. But yeah, but core Jewishness, you could say, is nomadic, always on the move.
Yeah, so that's kind of what I was wondering out loud, if there's something there that's a microcosm or an example of this, that when a movement, when something becomes a movement, it stops moving, that the innate experience of the sacred, of the hunter-gatherer thing, which is more about being horizontal and on the move and just embedded in life, and there is, as you say, quite a pragmatic element to Judaism even to this day, if that got lost, if we're saying that gets lost once they stop moving, if we can perceive that with the Jews, even in that early origin story. That their identity was very much in the Exodus, but it was all about getting to a promised land and then establishing the covenant and then becoming the chosen people of God. And then, well, the rest is history.
Yeah. There's also no real Messiah. There's been many Messiahs, not just one.
There's still charismatic figures, however.
Sure. Yeah. Moses was a charismatic figure, the original one.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. shit, you don't care if I come or go. If I died, you wouldn't be throwing roses yellow. You know what, fuck this shit, you don't care if I come or go. If I died, you wouldn't be throwing roses yellow.
Why do you have a Batman logo on your wall, Tim?
Oh, that's, you remember Prince's Bat Dance?
It's an album cover, is it?
It's the 45 cover.
I see. Mystery solved.
Yeah, those are mementos from my high school days.
Right. So this little line is probably not a departure point for a discussion, but it's just very central to my own exploration, so I needed to mark it. It's about skewed gender relations, a point Freud made many years ago in his essay The Psychology of Women. The mother, wrote Freud, can transfer to her son all the ambition she has had to suppress in herself and then live vicariously through his heroic life. So, I mean, it stood out for me because, again, the complementarity between a very involved mother, a mother who's very involved in the life of her infant son, and this hero complex. That in fact, the overly heroic male, the violent male, it may be possessed by his mother's unconscious. Just as Ed Gein and Norman Bates were. Okay, so on page 112, the cycle... Wait, I better read a bit before. At the heart of this energetic pattern is a deprivation of pleasure, of physical joy in the world, that leads the men in these cultures to renounce love, which they feel they cannot really get, and then disguise their despair in self-aggrandizement and ambition. The cycle continues when such a person looks down on his wife, becomes a poor husband, and effectively forces his wife into the arms of her son, who then fears women, needs to succeed, and so on. Was the glory of Greece worth it, asked Slater, if it required this narcissistic personality structure to make it possible? For the most part, his answer is no. In ancient Greece or 20th century America, we have great art and technology and a large body of knowledge, but the suffering on a deep emotional level is correspondingly great. This degree of narcissism, says Slater, means that life is never savoured, that the joys of the many are sacrificed to the achievements of the few. The majority of people in these cultures are left bitter because they operate out of the same value system yet can't achieve heroic status. And even heroes don't get to enjoy very much because what they have done is channel sensual pleasure and experiential immediacy into transcendent realms such as mastery and glory. According to Slater, it is not that we should try to eliminate narcissism altogether, but the point to which cultures such as Greece or America took it, or have taken it, is at the far end of the spectrum. The connection between intense mothering and the culture of achievement does seem to be intuitively correct, and it has some psychoanalytical data to support it. So then he gives some data. And then I marked a little below that. The Goetzels found that military sons had great difficulty in separating from their mothers, and that the overpossessive mother of a peer-rejected child, especially when relations with the husband are poor, is most likely to rear a military hero who enjoys the carnage of battle.
There's a lot to unpack there.
There is, yes. Maybe it speaks for itself. I mean, it's such a compelling mini thesis. As I said, I said on our first talk that the chapter in Prisoner Infinity that cites Lloyd DeMaus and is about the motherland and the way that the warriors are instilled with bloodlust through this attachment to the idea of the motherland is what Lloyd DeMaus talks about. That's a whole thorny patch that I was trying to make my way through in writing that chapter. I think it's a kind of forbidden knowledge in a way, or
Well, what stands out for me thinking of your family dynamic is did you see any of this playing out in your family with your mother and your father?
Can you narrow it down.
So was there a sense, because you said before, is that your mother was cold and distant. She blew hot and cold. There was no happy medium. She felt distant from your father, seems intuitively. Yeah. And your father was driven by his work. But was that also a sense of escape, or was that also that he was just hoodwinked into doing it because of his hatred towards his father? He got roped into it.
He also had a very domineering mother. I mean, his mother was like a matriarch. Mm-hmm. So that would be consistent with him being fueled by a kind of blind ambition that he himself didn't even get to enjoy the fruit of.
What about rage towards his mother? Did he have that?
Well, I never asked him, but I certainly inherited some. And it can't all just come from my personal relationship with my mother. And I certainly inherited this warrior mindset. Admittedly, mine was shamanized and spiritualized into the Castanadan warrior, but nonetheless, it manifested in similar ways. I mean, the hero's quest is a violent one. The Marshall McLuhan thing, all violence is the quest for identity. All forms of violence are sourced in a quest for identity. So whether it follows that all quests for identity are violent, I don't know. But my quest for identity, although it wasn't, you know, I would never join the army, and I wasn't a violent person in obvious ways, as you can tell by talking to me, I'm sure. But there was violence there, and the violence, my methods were quite violent, even if they were more self-abusive. Because I was so ferociously driven, I suspect, I mean, intuitively, this relates to what you zeroed in on correctly, that my quest for truth in the world was driven by a desire to get away from a toxic environment. So it was compromised. I wasn't just seeking truth that would benefit the community or even myself. I was actually trying to get away from something and then formulating the crucial fiction that I was, you know, a warrior on the quest for knowledge. So it seems as though that would relate also to... And my mother was typically... She did nothing with her life in her own terms. She felt that she'd done nothing with her life. There's no doubt that she was living vicariously through her sons, particularly because we were the achievers. We were both my brother and I lived extreme lives, and she, particularly my brother, she took great interest in his life. She did take interest in mine, of course. So I think it was different ways, actually. So, yeah, both of us in different ways.
We were both with your sister.
Well, as Berman doesn't get into it, but Dinnerstein does very much. The crucial difference between the way a female child's psyche is impacted by the primacy of a mother and a male is it's all a world of difference. Plus, my sister was the firstborn, which always makes a lot of difference as well. So I don't think it was equivalent, is all I can say. And certainly my sister wasn't driven, but I mean, it isn't. It is a male. Let's say it's a male pathology, but it's also a male quality to ambition, you know, achievement, war, struggle, questing for knowledge. All these things are the male.
Women, the women can just be, men must achieve.
Yes.
Type of thing.
Yes, and that's directly related to the fact that women are the same sex as their mother, so they already have the unitive trance state in their own bodies, particularly if they have children. Whereas a man, once he loses the trance state of the mother, he can't, of course that's why he becomes sex obsessed, like my father was, trying to literally merge with a woman's body. But it can't all be about sex, and if it isn't all about sex, then it becomes about these other kind of transcendent goals, where maybe I'm trying to fuse with the world by becoming famous, fuse with God by becoming a mystic. and so on, you know, fuse with the audience by becoming a writer even. There seem to be various different ways to somehow recapture this lost state of oneness, which is a kind of power.
Yeah. Let me go back to sex for a minute. So you said before that your father was sex obsessed. So that was an outgrowth, I assume, in many cases from his domineering mother. So that's the first question. But then related to that, I don't know how much you know about, this is a question, I don't know how much you know about bondage and things like that, whether that also is an outgrowth of that. A certain, I think the proper term to describe would be maybe paraphilia, something that's slightly outside the norm. And because I've never met anybody that's been into bondage, and I don't read much about the subject, but in the context of this conversation, I have to wonder is that this fascination that some people have with bondage, things like that, comes from a sense of maybe wanting to dominate because there's the doms and the subs, that much I know.
Yeah.
But also an obsession with sex in a slightly different way. Does that make sense? A roundabout way of getting to that.
Well, first thing is, I bet you have met somebody who's into bondage. I bet you've met quite a few of them. It's not as though they go, "Hi, my name's Bob and I'm into bondage." Unless you're at the right website.
Right, yeah.
I don't know
you like leather.
I mean, we find this out working in the thrift store, and you get these guys, macho guys, coming in looking at women's underwear and saying, "It's my girlfriend." We know they don't have a girlfriend. Interesting enough, my father was into being handcuffed. He went to prostitutes. Central to his breakup with my mother was that he did like bits on the side. He did want sex outside the marriage, and my mother didn't like that. And anyway, whether he was going to prostitutes that early, I don't know, but I know later on because I was told by one of his wives that he liked to be handcuffed. So he was literally into bondage. My brother probably was too. I have never been into bondage. I wouldn't mind tying up my wife and having my way with her, but we haven't gone there because I'm against too much kinkiness. I don't mind a little enactments and natural primal enactment, but I don't like bringing out accessories and things. Or I think it gets very twisted very fast if you.
Yeah.
It's contrived. So, but I only bring that very personal data up just to say that I do have a sympathy for it. I understand the need to dominate or the desire to dominate. I don't think it's... Well, I think the question of whether it's a kink or not is an important one, because I watch cats having sex, fucking, and it's absolutely a game of domination and submission. But it's not a game. It's deadly serious. In fact, I imagine... Male cats sometimes get killed by female cats, maybe, or lose an eye at least, because they don't spread their seed. I mean, if they give up, at least. So, and of course we get close to the real quick of, you know, really deep, dark and personal stuff, which is, you know, the sadistic impulse. The impulse to dominate is very close to the sadistic impulse, like they're on the same spectrum, and that's, you know, that can be absolutely pathological and have no place in nature at all. Although even there, a cat toys with a mouse, is that sadism? Well, it's the animal equivalent of it. So what was the question again?
Well, I was just curious to see what the connection was between this obsession with sex and bondage type of thing.
But the core was the mother... To do
right,
with
the, right, the mother, because you were saying is that your father was sex obsessed, and then you share the other tidbit is that he came from a domineering mother. So
yes.
I've heard such things before. It's nothing new to me, and it makes sense intuitively. But I was offshooting with the bondage. You mentioned
right.
that your father liked to be tied up. So is that something that maybe necessarily comes from being dominated by the mother, and that you want to return that, or just fulfilling that type of thing?
Well, I don't know, because it's so many variables. But I know that I used the term mother bondage for years, and I didn't think I'd coined such a term. But in fact, if you Google or whatever, you know, duck duck go go mother bondage, you just get lots of pornographic images. It's not actually a term from psychology. So what's my point there? There's clearly, I mean, the overlap's right there in the words.
Yeah.
And I mean, we're kind of it's hard to imagine a world before Freud. Like, we've internalized Freud so much that some things just seem very obvious, and maybe they're not. Maybe they're not even accurate. But to me, it does seem obvious that a child who had a domineering mother and or an absent one, because it could be both and. But this is also where it gets confusing, because opposite causes could have the same effect. But the main point is unhealthy maternal attachment, which can be a mother who's too close or a mother who's not close enough, or both. But the main thing, I think, is the separation doesn't happen in a natural, healthy way, or it never happens at all, in the case of Norman Bates. And in any event, you know, that dynamic would lead to a man who is obsessed constantly with having access to a woman's body. You don't have to join the dots, do you? They're right next to each other. They're the same thing being acted out. Now, the bondage, well, it makes sense that to tie a woman up, well, there's two things that come to mind. One is you've absolutely got guaranteed access to the woman's body there. She's not going anywhere. And number two, she can't resist you, but also more subtly and less well understood, she can't overwhelm you. She's passive. She's got to be passive. So what I experienced with my mother is it was bad enough that she wouldn't be there when I needed her, but then when she was there, she would suffocate me and I couldn't escape her. So that was just as terrifying. So for me, it makes sense that, and I don't want to get too personal here because it will get private, but it's very hard for me to find the balance where the woman, my partner, is close enough sexually, but not too much, not that I'll get frightened and overwhelmed by her closeness or by the intimacy. And so you can see how one would contrive paraphilias as a way to negotiate that danger zone.
Now, you're talking about the man is the dom, the woman is the sub, or what about the
No, it could side? Be both. Okay, yeah, so I didn't get into that. So, yeah, but then also if a man has a mother complex of any kind, total submission is also a way to avoid the danger zone, because then one has no will. One can't do anything anyway. Right? So...
Yeah.
So one's either reenacting the powerlessness, the original powerlessness, or one is enacting the flip side of it by having an experience of being powerful, but there would be two sides of the same coin. And I think consistently throughout, no matter what the relation or the dynamic is between an infant and the mother, the infant's always powerless. That's consistent. And the mother's always powerful, relatively.
Staying on the bondage track, now how would you now explain that when it comes to transgression and taboos? Have you discussed in Vice of Kings and elsewhere?
How would I explain it?
Yeah.
In the context of mother bondage, or?
No, I mean, if, okay, so say a man comes from a domineering mother. Okay, so that, one could reasonably say that sets him up for something like bondage, being the dom with the sub. But then when they start to cross the line to go to children, you know, so he's interested in dominating not a woman but a female child.
Yeah.
Or so now you're going into different territory here, and this is the previous theme.
Yeah, but the same principles apply in terms of a fear of intimacy and being overwhelmed and a desire to have absolute control. It seems as though it would be much more likely the dom type who would end up abusing children than the submissive type. But that's just a logical guess. I haven't had that thought before.
Yeah.
Of course, it could be politically incorrect to suggest a spectrum between BDSM and pedophilia, except the fact that pedophilia is in the process of being embraced by the by the liberal progressive community. So I don't know which, you know, it's hard to say, you know, from which angle one's looking at it. But to me, it's all a spectrum for sure. And it all comes back to the unhealthy attachment. Mm-hmm. So that was an interesting digression. I've got something on page 114.
Okay.
Shall I do that?
Sure, go ahead.
In essence, boys and girls have a very different problematic to deal with in terms of the hallowed presence of the powerful figure of the mother in the nursery. Being of the same gender as mom, girls find their identity by identifying with the mother, whereas boys find it by separating from her. So boys grow up learning to fear this energy, learning to become rational, and to distance themselves from their bodies and their emotions, which are seen as female. And then in parenthesis, falling in love, falling for charismatic leaders, going to war, or becoming alcoholics are often the only exceptions men will make to this distance in behavior. So yes, I can certainly relate to much of that.
Now, why do you think alcoholics are mentioned here? How do they try to resolve that through alcohol?
Well, it's a way to feel your emotions without losing your masculinity, because you could just say it's the alcohol. Mm-hmm. It's also kind of indirectly related. It's a way to go into this unitive trance state, sort of dreamy state, like being in the womb, second womb of alcohol. I should have more to say because, you know, I grew up in that stew, but that's partly why. The one thing I just want to mention is that to distance themselves from their bodies as well as their emotions, to me that's very key, that what I was doing most of my life, it was to do with this mother complex that I was trying to get free of, hence going on these heroic quests to find something. Really, it was to try and escape my mother's tentacles, and that was an occultism became central to it, and I became convinced that my soul was Lucifer and that my body belonged to Lucifer, and these weird beliefs that I ended up possessed by, they seemed to center around, as occultism very often does, I would say, a kind of renunciation of the body, or so does spirituality often as well. And right. I did terrible things to my body, not terrible, but I got tattoos and I took psychedelics and I smoked and I drank. And yeah, anyway, so that was just a point I wanted to make.
Well, also another point too is with men and feelings, trying to escape the feelings.
Yeah.
And I've read this elsewhere, is, you know, men feel differently than women do. I think we can agree on that. But, you know, and this is things I picked up from the psychological literature over the years, is that definitely men know anger and they know rage.
Yeah.
Tenderness, depends. Love, however you define love, depends.
Fear.
Fear, yes. I mean, nothing comes to mind, but definitely anger, sorrow.
Sorrow, yeah. Depression, sorrow, despair. Right. Men have a jurisdiction, is not the word. What's the word I'm looking for? They cornered the market on despair, I think. Which isn't to say women don't have it too, but I mean that men really, we really know despair, I would say.
Right. Particularly if they're contemplating suicide, men will follow through a lot more than women will.
Yeah. So what's your point in terms of the different emotional states that come more naturally to men versus women?
Well, part of that, I also wanted to piggyback on what you had mentioned, you know, down your path into occultism, whether you're also trying to escape feelings.
I think that's a safe bet in terms of, particularly if feelings incorporate sensations. So I was definitely trying to get away from, yes, unpleasant feelings, emotions and sensations in my body. By any and all means necessary. And to this day, I mean, I can still remember the volumes turned down enormously, but the angst of being me, of being Jake, as I was back then, was enormous. It was like the story of my life, and it included body pains. And I'm not saying I'm exceptional in this. I think it's practically the rule for human beings, but maybe especially men. It's a very Dostoevskian condition. Notes from Underground, you know, I'm a vile man, I'm a sick man, I think my liver is diseased. This is feeling there's something profoundly wrong with me. I got toxins flowing through my system, except I wasn't even able to perceive it that lucidly. It was more just, why can't I be happy? Why are my feelings tormenting me constantly?
And so looking back on that, what was the root cause of that?
What was the cause?
The cause is obviously would be the unresolved trauma.
Yeah, and I mean, this phrase not being at home in my body is what comes to mind, and one could unpack that for 2 hours, but
disassociation.
Dissociation, and you know, learning the methods of the tools and the techniques of dissociation is occultism and other things, and you know, all kinds of things. I mean, studying philosophy, reading books can be that too. But yeah, I think it all came down to not being at home in my home, and that was literally, it began in the womb. That home wasn't homely, or wasn't, you know, wasn't clean and loving. And then the home I was born into was kind of madhouse. And then of course, as I became aware of my body, and as my body developed, I pretty soon, you know, as soon as I was becoming autonomous in a legal sense or a psychological sense, I started, you know, doing bad things to my body. I started watching this torture porn, and smoking cigarettes and drinking alcohol all around the same period, about 13, 14.
Self-medication?
Well, yeah. I just never would have thought of it that way. I thought I was, as most people do, there's something really fascinating and exciting, and I'm going to experience it. Yeah. But yeah, with hindsight, I was actually trying to numb myself as much as possible, and even exciting or stimulating experiences have that effect because they desensitize.
Right. So could I pick up on that paragraph, because I highlighted lots in there too.
Okay.
So boys grow up learning to fear this energy by separating from her. Oh, sorry. So boys grow up learning to fear this energy, learning to become rational and to distance themselves from their bodies and their emotions, which are seen as female. Falling in love, falling for charismatic leaders, going to war, becoming alcoholics are often the only exceptions we'll make to this distancing behavior. But girls are nervous about this energy as well, and growing up fearing that they can never fulfill the, quote, goddess role that their mothers modeled for them on the unconscious level. So as women, they choose to collude in patriarchal arrangements, since the unstated premise is, let go of the gates of reason and logic, and all hell will break loose, which in our culture is absolutely true. And then a quote from Dinnerstein. Parental authority, writes Dinnerstein, is a sanctuary passionately cherished by the essential part of a person's self that wants to come up out of the drowning sweetness of early childhood into the bright, dry light of open day, the light of the adult realm in which human reason and human will, not the boundless and mysterious intentionality, the terrible, uncanny omniscience, and the nursery goddess can be expected, at least ideally, to prevail. And then Berman continues, the result is that women are deprived of power in our society. They are assigned the function of representing the soft underbelly, the zones of touch, emotion, intuition, and so on, while men represent the outside world, the life of mastery and adventure. Now, I would take issue with the one thesis is that women might not have direct power, but they have indirect power through men.
They certainly have influence, as we covered at the very start. They have far more influence than men in terms of being the primary caregiver. And of course now, I mean, things have changed even in the 20 years since he wrote that, although certainly it was present then. In terms of women having social power, they now have as much or more than men at certain levels. It's difficult to say at higher levels because they're invisible.
Right.
But certainly, women in positions of authority now is very, very common, and but it does seem to depend on women accessing a masculine way of being in their bodies and in the world. So it's possible that his thesis is still correct. It's just not sociologically, it's not necessarily sociologically observable in the same way, like something is changing over time there. But I suspect, and I'm intuiting now, that that this difference between male and female power, and I'm not sure he's addressing it here, or maybe he does in the next chapter, relates to the thing in the previous chapter about how we can't, in our present cultural mindset, we don't recognize the power of those ancient communities because it wasn't hierarchical, and it wasn't about coercion. And that, I think, relates to the difference between male power and female power. And maybe they're both, like, they would both be out of balance without each other, I imagine. But certainly the male principle of power, it seems, without the balancing aspect of the female, does seem to be about aggression and coercion. And so that kind of power is dominant in our world today.
Right. His earlier point about the where in a hunter-gatherer society, it would have been more difficult to say, well, who's the parent? Because the child is passed around, you know. You're trying to be cautious when I'm using that term, but it's not focusing just on the one parent. It's within the larger, within the extended family of the larger tribe. But, you know, he doesn't specifically, or then the anthropologists don't specifically cite anything about men. But what I draw from that, I extrapolate, is that there probably wasn't too bold a distinction between the two. Between men and women, like there is in modern day societies, that this is the male sphere, this is the female sphere. This female sphere, particularly in the past 30 years, have been trying to make inroads into the male sphere, and so adopting the clothes of the male to try to retain power in the same way that males have. And now you have this imbalance where males are becoming females and females are becoming males. That's an issue. But in the hunter-gatherer society, things are more diffuse. Of course, there are males and females, and you can point to this guy and say he's the father of this child, and this woman is the mother of that child.
And
but it's not,
roles,
but it's not, yeah. Right. But it's not so distinct, because again, the child is part of a larger community, as are the parents themselves.
Well, if the sense of individual existence was less clearly defined, then presumably by the same token, the difference between a man and a woman would be less clearly defined at a conceptual level. It doesn't mean it would be less apparent in terms of the men doing the hunting and the women doing the gathering, or whatever it would be.
Or the sexual difference, you know,
or the sexual
depending on
difference.
Body parts.
Well, yes, that's presumably always going to be obvious until we get to the post-human future, the post-gender. and indeed, you know, the concept of gender is a new concept. It's less than 100 years old, unless we're talking about language. So in other words, a social construct relating to identification pertaining to biological sex is a new thing, right? So yeah, if we remove that in our imagination, then the differences between men and women might have been more acute than ever they are now, but they wouldn't have been relevant. If you see what I mean, there wouldn't have been concerns,
right? Just not something they would think of.
So I think, I mean, what's coming to that, because I'd like to finish it on something more conclusive, is that there would be the cooperative aspect of male and female would be the dynamic thing, as opposed to men do this and women do that, and then actually it ends with competing. But even the idea that they do separate things could lead to competition. Whereas if there's a fundamental cooperation there, which there is, of course, I mean, if you're going to create a child, you have to cooperate, right? The very inception of life. Exactly. So that principle, maybe that principle precedes the individuality of the sexes, as in it's a dyad before it becomes a polarity.
Okay. Well, maybe we can close out by the rest of the paragraph. Same paragraph that I was reading from before. So he continues, once again, this gives women too much power in the nursery. And dad, by contrast, gets to represent the healthy, rational breeze that blows through the family unit. The next generation picks up this bipolar lesson quickly and in turn passes it on. Clearly then, we cannot really understand the psychogenesis of dominance and hierarchy without referring to gender relations. Under conditions of such dyadic intensity, men are driven not merely to dominate women in nature, but to prove their masculinity by dominating other men. A satirical title of a few years ago, Real Men Don't Bond, captures the tragic truth of all this. For both sexes, the fear of a large, dark, irrational, chaotic, and in my view, primarily Neolithic energy, just seething below the surface, waiting to erupt at any moment, and only dimly perceived, is enough to make social inequality and hierarchical arrangements the guarantors of order and stability extremely attractive. Dinnerstein concludes that only by drawing men into the child-rearing process can the female domination of the nursery be broken and women's terrifying mythological status be reduced.
It's a good, strong point to end on. And it would lead us naturally into, of course, the next chapter and this whole question of the goddess. It's also the perfect opportunity for me to plug my men's group on Tuesday mornings. I was going to read Dinnerstein to them recently, but it's a very free-flow, organic one. It's not very intellectual or heady, the men's group, I'm glad to say. So I never got round to it, but I did feel it would be a vital perspective for men. I think it is a vital perspective to men to recognize that all this goddess hoopla is really a smokescreen for the hidden power and influence of women in our world, and I'm not sure how to finish that thought, but for me, male bonding, the cliche, not the cliche, but the reality that's become a cliche, has really been central and essential to my own well-being.
It's not easy to accomplish, though, as I found.
No, it's not at all.
It's multifactorial. You can't put your finger on just one thing.
But we're working on it.
Oh, you can do. So we should end there?
That's the end of this week's Liminalist, the third part of the exploration of Maurice Boehm's book Wandering God. I will continue this exploration with Tim Kay, possibly even next week. I'm not sure. I don't have a podcast yet lined up for next week. Just at the very final stages of 16 Maps of Hell, waiting for the proofs to arrive. I hope that will be tomorrow. Maybe by the time you listen to this, you'll have received an email from me giving you a full update. The publication date has been delayed due to printer problems to roughly November the 11th. But, well, it'll take a few more weeks to get to you, probably. Thanks for listening to the Liminalist Podcast Between. I don't know whether this will continue, but most likely it will. Definitely in a period of full-on transition currently, so prepare to make the launch from one continent to the next, and from one life to the next. The things you begin with, the things that you end with, changes in the heart, change with the times. Changes in the stars, change.
the night. Strangers in the heart, stay up until light. Dangers in your soul, they motion to the stars. Changes in the heart, change with the dark.